Visa said, I want to talk a little bit about, from a practitioner and from a valuation specialist point of view, the issues, you know, as the market evolved and today, relating to valuation in practice for credit default swaps. So the areas I want to touch on are the transaction terms, which Professor Saunders went over in his presentation, how that affects valuation, the market practices, what are people currently doing to value these contracts, and then valuation specifically under the statement, the FASB 157, how does that fit into that new accounting standard? What are some of the issues practitioners are dealing with under FAS 157 in this environment? And I think there'll be another talk later about using credit default swaps to assess credit risk on other instruments rather than credit default swaps in the derivative market. And then finally, just to touch on what the market would look like if we move from an over-the-counter market to a clearinghouse, or even one step farther to over-the-counter, I mean, from over-the-counter to an exchange type of instrument. So again, we went through some of the nuts and bolts, but really these are derivative instruments. They derive, you know, their value from an underlying. So it's the underlying, essentially, that's going to move the price on these assets. To date, these have been over-the-counter transactions, again, bilateral, two parties. There's no real exchange here. Again, the ISDA documents dictate the transaction. The kind of document package is the ISDA master agreement that sets forth the trading relationships between the two parties under which multiple derivatives can be traded. Interest rate derivatives, commodity derivatives, and credit default swaps would fall within this ISDA master. So the master agreement sets forth the trading terms, and then the confirmation, the trade confirmation, outlines the specific details of the transaction. So those are kind of important things to look at. You know, as one part I'll talk about again in terms of counterparty risk, the credit support annex or the CSA will outline the terms of collateralization in these contracts, and that's sometimes important in the current market in terms of, you know, what we've seen when there are defaults or when there are downgrades to the counterparty. And I think one important thing to look at is that these contracts defined are really in whole defined by a number of things. One is the underlying, the specific terms of the contract, and the collateral terms between the two parties. That's going to really determine the end of day cash flows rather than just you know, the valuation of the instrument. So moving forward, the terms, again, are determined by the structure of the trade and the trading relationship between the buyer and seller. We have a variety of instruments today that we see at Grant Thornton in terms of our clients. What are they referencing with these CDS? The first, Professor Saunders talked about in terms of the single name CDS, right? This is referencing a single name, a single asset, Ford, GM, you know, that's a single name contract on. And they can reference corporate bonds as kind of the deliverable, the underlying asset. Sometimes it's more broad, borrowed money. We also see specific contracts that are set up for loans. These are LCDS, so taking into consideration particular features of loans, given that they're bullet structures, they have seniority in the capital structure, higher recovery. And then sovereign debt as well. You know, one thing we've seen recently that you wouldn't expect is now there's you know, fairly significant volume trading on U.S. currency or U.S. debt, right? And that trades in European currency, but it's a new instrument you hadn't thought of before. But now, you know, in changing that market, we've seen that. CDS on asset-backed securities, we've also seen that emerge, I think, in the last 4 or 5 years. I remember back in the market in 2004, in a low spread environment, people were wanting to take exposure to these instruments, and you couldn't find anyone who wanted to buy protection on those, right? And so how much things have changed with the cracks in the subprime market now, you know, no one wants to be on that side of the trade at all. In terms of the credit indices, the CDX is the one that references the corporate names. There's a North American index. There's the equivalent in Europe. The ABX, this one referencing the subprime market, sometimes called the home equity market. These are subprime borrowers. And that, you've seen a lot of activity in terms of different vintages there. These are compilations of, in each case, 20 reference assets for different vintages representing different tranches of subprime securitization. So unless you take a bet synthetically on cash instruments, both, you know, long or short, buying credit protection or selling protection. CMBX, this one's seen a lot of activity, especially in the AAA space, in terms of commercial mortgages, right? So securitizations of commercial mortgages, referencing those, and in a market where you're not seeing active trading in the underlying, sometimes this derivative index is going to have more information, potentially more volume, right? We're in that state as we come to year end. You're not seeing the underlyings trade. You know, what to what extent does this index give you an information about the value of the credit default swap contract, or maybe even the value of the underlying? There's also a new index, the Muni Index. You've seen that's been in the news recently, where there's a portfolio of municipal obligations, kind of state GO bonds. Those are pooled together in a reference basket, and then there's trading back and forth on that. So names like California, New York, et cetera, and you're seeing that index, I think now, just recently, it was wider than the corporate investment grade index. So again, municipal bonds not trading very frequently. You have this index, but who are the buyers and sellers on this index? What's the volume behind that? But again, it is an instrument that allows you to take a view. And then we've all seen these packaged into, on one hand, credit default swaps on CDOs themselves. This is what got a number of market participants in trouble. One trade often done was a negative basis transaction where a European bank would buy the asset, hold it on their balance sheet, and then hedge that exposure with a monoline insurer or with an insurance company or net protection seller. And so they'd kind of earn that differential. They'd hold the cash asset, and then they'd look to a counterparty. The typical assets on that had been ABS CDOs. Obviously, you see all this with Merrill and their big counterparty too. AIG on some of these assets, CLOs, you saw that with a lot of European Yankee banks where they buy the CLO and then buy protection on that asset. And so it's a negative basis because the cash bond is yielding more than the protection, at least at that time. So market participants use a variety of methodologies. The main method really people are using and have used through time is kind of market quotations. You don't have anything observable in terms of an exchange, right? There aren't observable transactions to date. They're starting to see that with potentially this warehouse, or this clearinghouse, or an exchange-based vehicle. So going back in time, I think when you started with the first kind of portfolio credit default swaps or first, single names that were on a standalone basis and invitation basis, there was really no observable quotations and no observable prices. I think the next step in the evolution were dealer runs. So dealer would send periodically, hopefully once a day, runs that gave the names they trade and the bid-ask spreads on those names. So they might have 100 reference names and they'd send you the bid and ask, and it were kind of indicative prices, not necessarily where you'd be looking to trade. And so they'd send end of day a PDF document with 100 names on that. And if you had those positions, you'd look to compile those documents and try to price the assets you had on your book. That moved into, as the market evolved, providers emerged to provide this information as a standalone service. Some of the first ones were some of the dealers, some of the interdealer brokers in this asset class. CreditX was one. GFI is another interdealer broker, and Market Partners, which is kind of developed as a from dealers as their backing as a consortium. So in that instance, dealers send quotes to Market Partners. Market Partners compiles those, cleans them, and then sends them off for a fee to subscribing investors. And so that gave you another level up in terms of transparency. You can also, that service is available as kind of a real-time service, as an end-of-day service. And then to supplement that, there continue to be dealer runs. Typically now this is a Bloomberg type of interface where you'll send a message, and that message will have different quotes. And then again, there's new services that'll go in and use technology to parse those quotations and compile that data for valuation services. So really, again, multiple different sources, but you're getting quotations basically as your method of pricing. And then you're moving to less liquid instruments. You're back into kind of a discount cash flow, matrix pricing, possibly valuation based on the underlying bond value. You may see that now with instruments where you have a CDS on a home equity or subprime bond that's a junior class in the tranche, like a AAA subprime. These things have, in many cases, been written down or are likely to be written down as defaults and delinquencies kind of pile up in the underlying security, and there's kind of a pending payment on a credit default issuing. So there you might look at the underlying bond and say that gives you the best indication of what the CDS contract is like, is worth, since it hasn't been settled out. Here's just an example of a market quotation example. So here's a Market Partners, an example on their page of a single name. Here's ITV. And you know, they're referencing different terms from 1 year on the top, it's a little small, to 7 years, giving a bid and ask spread. On the bottom there, they show the most liquid tenor, which is a five-year tenor. And here in the five-year tenor, again, bid and ask quotations, and they show the source. This is a next level up in terms of your pricing service and the time of day, right? So sometimes there's considerations in terms of what time are you actually getting that price. You know, if you're getting a midday price, that price is an active, you know, live bid or indication to trade. You know, what does that mean at the end of day? So there's a consideration of, you know, what's really behind that price and how much volume is there. And moving on, you know, what do you do in practice in terms of nuts and bolts to convert that spread into a fair value? And there's a variety of methodologies, but I'd say a market practitioner can go on to Bloomberg, pull up a terminal, and use a standardized model. JP Morgan model is one that's been used in the market. So they're one of the leaders in the credit derivatives market. Here we have a sample security, and the key terms have been outlined. There's a set of payment dates, there's an effective date, there's a maturity date. We're valuing this one as of the 2nd of December. This case, a hypothetical owner of the asset is buying protection, and so they paid 260 basis points. On the bottom right-hand part of the screenshot here, you see the dates, and to that I'm just putting in a flat spread. So say the market quotation now is 450 basis points. So they bought protection for 260, and now they are able to go out in the market and kind of offset that with 450 basis points. So in this case, I had hypothetically at Citigroup, so the perceived default risk on Citigroup has increased. Now it costs 450 basis points a year to protect against a default or a credit event by Citi. What you do basically is there's a calculation method to convert those spreads into default probabilities. You generate cash flows, and you end up with kind of your fair market value. In this case, it's, you know, $700,000. They're in the money on this contract for a $10 million notional, and the $700,000 is the market value. So, again, moving on to kind of the FAS 157 or a derivative accounting, that would be the price to kind of tear up the trade. So, conceivably, you know, ignoring kind of counterparty risk at this point, they would receive $700,000 to tear up this trade, or they'd enter into an offsetting trade and kind of have a locked in gain of $700,000, given that the, you know, default risk has increased since they entered the contract. Then moving on to the more technical side of FAS 157, here participants are asked to value these assets, the derivatives. You're clearly in the 157 world. Here's the price to sell an asset or transfer a liability in an orderly transaction between market participants at the measurement date. The key terms here are it's an exit price, so it's not the bid or ask, it's whatever side you're on, what's the exit price, what can you get out of this trade for, what can you unwind this derivative for. There are no block discounts, so even if there's thin trading and you have a large position on your reporting statements, you don't need to take that into account. A big question on a number of assets, and CDS is included, is forced sales or not orderly transactions. So, you know, is market data indicative of forced sales? Is this an orderly market? You want to do it in the principal market. Again, this is an over-the-counter type market. So, we've seen in terms of information, in terms of the market participants, dealers are major counterparties in terms of buying and selling protection in this market. So they're a good place to look in terms of where that asset's going to be unwound. Adjustments for non-performance risk. We see this with both CDS and with other assets, and sometimes I think one of the other panelists will talk about using CDS to estimate the risk of non-payment on other contracts, such as interest rate contracts or just other over-the-counter assets or liabilities. And then there's also a question in terms of markets that are no longer active. You know, a lot of times in cash markets or in the, you know, CDO market or in structured finance securities, what to do in that case, right? And I think from the accounting side, we're still seeing that it looks like there's no guidance that you shouldn't maximize the use of observable inputs. And this comes into account in terms of using credit derivative indications for assets on cash instruments that are not actively traded. Again, there's the value hierarchy in terms of reporting is level 1, 2, or 3. Level 1 are assets under 157 that are traded. You get a quote for an identical asset in an active market. And so these are markets that occur with sufficient frequency to provide pricing information on an ongoing basis. What does this mean? You know, some people have said at least weekly, daily, and it depends on the asset. But in this case, for a CDS, you're not going to see them level one because you don't have you don't have an exchange kind of based instrument yet. So again, it's going to move into like a level two type adjustment.
Here
is level
two. Justin, we're going to have to wrap up here. We're getting a bit time, and we want to get some questions in. So.
Okay. I want to move to, I'll just highlight some of the questions that we have. Okay, I mean, I think one main, you know, following point, I think, on these instruments is that, you know, the counterparty risk, I think, is a key aspect of credit derivatives, and they're significantly different from interest rate swaps in that the cash flows really are not symmetric, right? As they showed in the graph before, you're typically on an investment-grade reference credit getting a small amount of premium payments or receiving a small amount for a potentially large payment upon default. And it, you know, works in an orderly process until you get that default event, all right? And for recent examples, we've seen the kind of non-symmetry in terms of there. It really depends on, you know, who's your counterparty, who you're trading with, and is there collateralization behind that? On the one hand, you'd had the monoline insurance companies where they took, you know, kind of net protection seller exposures, but didn't have any collateralization to that. And you saw how those contracts worked out, and it's still kind of being worked out in terms of those transactions. And then on the other hand, you had the example of AIG, which we've talked to, where there, again, turned out to be a large net protection seller. You had defaults or had downgrades on the assets, and then you had a concurrent downgrade on their rating, which triggered collateral payments, realized cash outflows or collateral payments under the CSA. So that's something else to look at. And so I think in valuing these, it's important to consider, you know, the assets, the underlying assets, where the quotes are coming from, but also the trading relationship between these parties, as they are intertwined and kind of you can't separate the value of the instrument from that trading relationship between the parties.
Thank you. Yep. Bill, I'm going to ask you to start with some questions, and the audience is also we welcome audience participation in this as well.
One question I'll throw out, and it's not a softball, but to Bob or Bob or Professor Saunders, there's been a lot of media attention to the interplay between the CDS spreads and what later became runs on capital of a number of institutions, like Wachovia, for example. That's probably the most infamous one, where you had the Friday run on the capital. And I would love to hear either of your comments on whether there was, in fact, an interrelationship. It's been argued that short speculators, able to manipulate the CDS spreads on a daily basis in order to, you know, accomplish that type of catastrophic result at the capital level. And do you think that's a fact? Do you think that happened?
I guess a couple of things. I assume my mic works okay. A couple of things about that is, you know, the whole Lehman situation, up until that weekend, there was kind of an assumption that, you know, somebody like a Lehman or a Wachovia or Morgan Stanley or Goldman Sachs, that they, you know, would somehow be propped up given the Bear Stearns experience earlier in the year. And, you know, people woke up on Monday morning or found out Sunday night that it wasn't going to happen. That wasn't going to be a given. And so the reaction flowed through concern about the creditworthiness of some of these other massive dealers who, you know, make, you know, the investment banks make money through leverage. So there was a serious concern about their creditworthiness. So I think a lot of the spread was reflecting that concern. The other thing I'd say, and I hearken back to the bilateral nature of these contracts, people speculate, meaning members of the press or other people, observers of the market speculate that, you know, you can get these groups of people together and they're going to agree that all of a sudden they're going to run up the spread on the credit default swaps. And because they see that happen and they suspect that somehow people are trying to do that so they can maybe profit on short positions on the stock. Well, first of all, if that's what they're doing, then there's manipulation going on in the stock price in effect, and therefore, you know, there's action to be taken. Plus, the SEC has anti-fraud and anti-manipulation authority as it relates to credit default swaps. But the other thing is that just the bilateral nature of the contract makes it very difficult to individually do all these bilateral contracts to send messages to the marketplace where you're actually contracting to pay a premium, and each time you're entering into a new contract, you're probably paying a higher premium by definition if your real intent is to drive down the price of the stock. And so I'm not sure how that really plays out in reality.
It would have to be a massive collusion, right? And you couldn't hide something like that in the market. So many bilateral
I think also there'd be a tremendous benefit. The person who broke that collateral, that collusion would make a lot of money if the people were wrong. So there's a tremendous benefit for someone to see things the other way and profit from that view. I think that you'd have not only have collusion, you'd have to make sure that it was not breakable in order to be able to really go against a certain company or somebody or country.
Mm-hmm. I think the Wachovia case is a perfect example of why you need exchange traded derivatives. And that's where they're going to come.
Because of
transparency. Yeah.
And, you know, for Justin, I'd ask the question, what effect, if any, do you think the creation of a clearinghouse or exchange will have on valuation process? Easier, harder? What's the result?
I mean, I think that portion of it for, you know, those contracts that do become traded on these exchanges, you know, would make it easier. Just kind of seeing that transparency from a valuation side. But that said, you know, there's still going to be the need for over-the-counter transactions and credit derivatives that will not fall into that. Like, there's a question of, all right, what are the contracts that are going to have enough liquidity to be on that type of exchange? Is it going to be 5-year contracts? What happens if you have a basket trade? What happens if you're now at a 3-year contract? So I think it will improve just having transparency in terms of seeing observable prices and seeing observable volumes. But, you know, the market has to, decide where there's, you know, where they're going to decide where the volume is and where that activity is.
And Bob, does ISDA or Professor, does ISDA or the other market watchers think that an exchange will create even greater standardization than what's being sought with respect to these various types of products, whether it's basket or a single?
Yeah, I don't know if it'll create greater standardization, because the reality is we have a fairly high degree of standardization.
True.
Via the documentation and also some of these decisions that have been made over the years in the market about market practice in terms of payment dates and discussions now about coupons. So I don't think it'll drive that much more standardization. It'll just provide another outlet for hedging risk in the way that, you know, in other markets where there's an OTC product and a similar exchange-traded product, dealers in particular will actively manage their risk in their OTC business by utilizing the tools in the exchange world. And I think it's just the fact that this business has always started as an OTC business, has grown up as an OTC business, and therefore, unlike other markets where the exchange-traded product either pre-existed the OTC or grew up alongside.
I think that unless we have some scintillating question from the audience here, we're going to move on to our... Yes.
Credit default swaps instead of rating agencies altogether? Is that
basically...
Could they replace those organizations?
Yeah. Well, basically what the implied ratings are is that they would take the CDS spreads or traditionally AAA rated companies and recalibrate them to get a CDS spread for these new implied ratings.
But the rating agencies also have other functions, not just existing. They also create... ratings for new issuances for which there's no data, no public data.
No, I mean, the CDS spread implied ratings can only be for companies that have CDSs traded, but they're the big companies and they're the ones. I mean, what does a bank care about for bankruptcy? It doesn't care about the small guy. It worries about the top 400 or 500, and that's where we're going to get the implied ratings being important. And in fact, now you think Moody's have 3 different rating systems. They have the traditional rating system, implied ratings, and they have KMV, which is based on probability of default calculation based on equity returns. So I think the puzzle for an investor is, which one do I use?
And
they can never be wrong, because when MBIA is AAA under traditional ratings and CCC under implied ratings, and they say, you chose the wrong one. And anyway, you don't pay us for them anyway. The issuer pays for them. So why should, you know, we worry about you? Then they can't lose.
I was just going to add that there's been a lot of, you know, suggestion that, and this goes back several years, that if you see the CDS spread of a company go up, that must mean they're going to go bankrupt, and, you know, trying to almost attribute too much importance to the CDS spread. Now, as the market's grown, as there's liquidity, they will become more relevant for that type of determination. But I always say in response to that, hold on, let's not shift, you know, the world of ratings completely over to the credit default swap world. Let's appreciate the fact that we now have a tool that didn't exist 5-10 years ago that introduces a lot of additional transparency into the pricing of credit and lets investors utilize that tool so that your analysis of credit is even more comprehensive and robust than it may have existed before the advent of credit derivatives.
Okay. There's a question up here. Can you pass?
Insurance they were providing on things that the rating agencies or no one else could value on the pools and what value they were providing the credit and the spread spiked because of people not being able to value it. So the rating agencies and the markets were kind of paralyzed. No one knew what the underlying uncertainty was. So I don't think, you know, any of this is going to solve that because those underlying instruments still can't be valued.
No, I think they could be. I mean, I think that's where the insurance agencies did the worst job, and rating agencies was on rating the credit default swap tranches of the securitization products because they really misestimated what was a AAA or where the breakpoint was for AAA. As you know, there's breakpoints based on loss rates, and basically what happens, and you can easily show it through simulation, is that if the default rates are much more highly correlated than expected, which we know they were in a crisis, and if credit risk volatility, however you measure it, was much bigger, then the AAAs really get hit. And I think where it went wrong, these models, was they misestimated both of those true factors. And I think once you look at it, it seems explicable ex post, but ex ante, you know, these things are difficult to value.
And compounded by fair value accounting. Because prior to that, there wasn't mark-to-market accounting.
We better give somebody else a turn.
Okay.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.